This is Audible.
The Dark is Rising by Susan Cooper. Read by Alex Jennings. Part 1. The Finding. Midwinter's Eve.
Too many!
James shouted and slammed the door behind him.
What?
Said Will.
Too many kids in this family, that's what. Just too many!
James stood fuming on the landing like a small, angry locomotive, then stumped across to the window seat and stared out at the garden. Will put aside his book and pulled up his legs to make room.
I could hear all the yelling,
he said, chin on knees.
Wasn't anything, James said. Just stupid Barbara again, bossing. Pick up this, don't touch that. And Mary joining in, twitter, twitter, twitter. You'd think this house was big enough, but there's always people.
They both looked out of the window. The snow lay thin and apologetic over the world. That wide grey sweep was the lawn, with the straggling trees of the orchard still dark beyond. The white squares were the roofs of the garage, the old barn, the rabbit hutches, the chicken coops. Further back, there were only the flat fields of Dawson's farm, dimly white-striped. All the broad sky was grey, full of more snow that refused to fall. There was no colour anywhere.
4 days to Christmas, Will said. I wish it would snow properly. And your birthday tomorrow?
He had been going to say that too, but it would have been too much like a reminder. And the gift he most wished for on his birthday was something nobody could give him. It was snow, beautiful, deep, blanketing snow, and it never came. At least this year there was the grey sprinkle, better than nothing. He said, remembering a duty,
I haven't fed the rabbits yet. Want to come?
Booted and muffled, they clumped out through the sprawling kitchen. A full symphony orchestra was swelling out of the radio. Their eldest sister, Gwen, was slicing onions and singing. Their mother was bent, broad-beamed and red-faced over an oven.
Rabbits,
she shouted, when she caught sight of them.
And some more hay from the farm.
We're going,
Will shouted back. The radio let out a sudden, hideous crackle of static as he passed the table. He jumped. Mrs. Stanton shrieked,
Turn that thing down!
Outdoors, it was suddenly very quiet. Will dipped out a pail of pellets from the bin in the farm-smelling barn, which was not really a barn at all, but a long, low building with a tiled roof, once a stable. They tramped through the thin snow to the row of heavy wooden hutches, leaving dark footmarks on the hard, frozen ground. Opening doors to fill the feed boxes, Will paused, frowning. Normally, the rabbits would be huddled sleepily in corners, only the greedy ones coming twitch-nosed forward to eat. Today they seemed restless and uneasy, rustling to and fro, banging against their wooden walls. One or two even let back an alarm when he opened their doors. He came to his favourite rabbit, named Chelsea, and reached in as usual to rub him affectionately behind the ears. But the animal scuffled back away from him and cringed into a corner, the pink-rimmed eyes staring up blank and terrified.
Hey,
Will said, disturbed.
Hey, James, look at that. What's the matter with him? And all of them?
Well, they seem all right to me.
Well, they don't to me. They're all jumpy, even Chelsea. Hey, come on, boy.
But it was no good.
Funny,
James said with mild interest, watching.
I dare say your hands smell wrong.
You must have touched something they don't like. Same as dogs and aniseed, but the other way round.
I haven't touched anything. Matter of fact, I just washed my hands when I saw you.
There you are, then, James said promptly. That's the trouble. They've never smelt you clean before. Probably all die of shock.
Ha, very ha.
Will attacked him, and they scuffled together, grinning, while the empty pail toppled rattling on the hard ground. But when he glanced back as they left, the animals were still moving distractedly, not eating yet, staring after him with those strange, frightened, wide eyes.
"There might be a fox about again, I suppose,"
James said.
"Remind me to tell Mum."
No fox could get at the rabbits in their sturdy row, but the chickens were more vulnerable. A family of foxes had broken into one of the hen-houses the previous winter and carried off 6 nicely fattened birds just before marketing time. Mrs. Stanton, who relied on the chicken money each year to help pay for 11 Christmas presents, had been so furious she had kept watch afterwards in the cold barn 2 nights running, but the villains had not come back. Will thought that if he were a fox, he would have kept clear too. His mother might be married to a jeweller, but with generations of Buckinghamshire farmers behind her, she was no joke when the old instincts were roused. Tugging the handcart, a homemade contraption with a bar joining its shafts, he and James made their way down the curve of the overgrown drive and out along the road to Dawson's farm. Quickly past the churchyard, its great dark yew trees leading out over the crumbling wall, more slowly by Rook's Wood on the corner of Church Lane. The tall spinney of horse chestnut trees, raucous with the calling of the rooks and rubbish roofed with the clatter of their sprawling nests, was one of their familiar places.
Hark at the rooks! Something's disturbed them.
The harsh, irregular chorus was deafening, and when Will looked up at the treetops, he saw the sky dark with wheeling birds. They flapped and drifted to and fro. There were no flurries of sudden movement, only this clamorous, interweaving throng of rooks.
An owl?
They're not chasing anything. Come on, Will. It'll be getting dark soon.
That's why it's so odd for the rooks to be in a fuss. They all ought to be roosting by now.
Will turned his head reluctantly down again, but then jumped and clutched his brother's arm, his eye caught by a movement in the darkening lane that led away from the road where they stood. Church Lane. It ran between Rook's Wood and the churchyard to the tiny local church, and then on to the River Thames.
Hey!
What's up?
There's someone over there. Or there was. Looking at us.
James sighed.
So what? Just someone out for a walk. No, he wasn't.
Will screwed up his eyes nervously, peering down the little side road.
It was a weird-looking man, all hunched over, and when he saw me looking, he ran off behind a tree. Scuttled, like a beetle.
James heaved at the handcart and set off up the road, making Will run to keep up.
It's just a tramp, then. I don't know, everyone seems to be going batty today. Barb and the rabbits and the rooks, and now you, all twitchety-yacking. Come on, let's get that hay. I want my tea.
The handcart bumped through the frozen ruts into Dawson's yard, the great earthen square enclosed by buildings on three sides, and they smelt the familiar farm smell. The cowshed must have been mucked out that day. Old George, the toothless cattleman, was piling dung across the yard. He raised a hand to them. Nothing missed, old George. He could see a hawk drop from a mile away. Mr. Dawson came out of a barn.
"Ah," he said. "Hey for Stanton's farm?"
It was his joke with their mother because of the rabbits and the hens.
James said, "Yes, please."
"It's coming,"
Mr. Dawson said.
Old George had disappeared into the barn.
"Keep 'em well, then. Tell your mum I'll have 10 birds off her tomorrow, and 4 rabbits. Don't look like that, young Will. If it's not their happy Christmas, it's one for the folks as'll have 'em."
He glanced up at the sky, and Will thought a strange look came over his lined brown face. Up against the lowering grey clouds, 2 black rooks were flapping slowly over the farm in a wide circle.
"The rooks are making an awful din today," James said. "Will saw a tramp up by the wood."
Mr. Dawson looked at Will sharply.
"What was he like?"
"Just a little old man. He dodged away."
"So, the walker is abroad,"
the farmer said softly to himself.
"Ah. He would be."
"Nasty weather for walking," James said cheerfully.
He nodded at the northern sky over the farmhouse roof. The clouds there seemed to be growing darker, massing in ominous grey mounds with a yellowish tinge. The wind was rising too. It stirred their hair, and they could hear a distant rustling from the tops of the trees.
"More snow coming," said Mr. Dawson.
"It's a horrible day," said Will suddenly,
surprised by his own violence. After all, he had wanted snow. But somehow, uneasiness was growing in him.
"It's creepy, somehow."
"It will be a bad night," said Mr. Dawson.
"There's old George with the hay," said James. "Come on, Will."
"You go," the farmer said. "I want Will to pick up something for your mother from the house."
But he did not move, as James pushed the handcart off towards the barn. He stood with his hands thrust deep into the pockets of his old tweed jacket, looking at the darkening sky.
"The walker is abroad," he said again. "This night will be bad, and tomorrow will be beyond imagining."
He looked at Will, and Will looked back in growing alarm into the weathered face, the bright dark eyes creased narrow by decades of peering into sun and rain and wind. He had never noticed before how dark Farmer Dawson's eyes were. Strange in their blue-eyed county.
"You have a birthday coming," the farmer said.
"Hmm," said Will.
"I have something for you."
He glanced briefly round the yard and withdrew one hand from his pocket. In it, Will saw what looked like a kind of ornament made of black metal, a flat circle quartered by two crossed lines. He took it, fingering it curiously. It was about the size of his palm and quite heavy, roughly forged out of iron, he guessed, though with no sharp points or edges. The iron was cold to his hand.
"What is it?" he said.
"For a moment," Mr. Dawson said. "Just call it something to keep. To keep with you always, all the time. Put it in your pocket now, and later on, loop your belt through it and wear it like an extra buckle."
Will slipped the iron circle into his pocket.
"Thank you very much," he said, rather shakily.
Mr. Dawson, usually a comforting man, was not improving the day at all. The farmer looked at him in the same intent, unnerving way, until Will felt the hair rise on the back of his neck. Then he gave a twisted half-smile with no amusement in it, but a kind of anxiety.
"Keep it safe, Will. And the less you happen to talk about it, the better. You will need it after the snow comes."
He became brisk.
"Come on now. Mrs. Dawson has a jar of her mincemeat for your mother."
They moved off towards the farmhouse. The farmer's wife was not there, but waiting in the doorway was Maggie Barnes, the farm's round-faced, red-cheeked dairymaid, who always reminded Will of an apple. She beamed at them both, holding out a big white crockery jar tied with a red ribbon.
"Thank you, Maggie," Farmer Dawson said.
"Missus said you'd been wanting it for young Will here," Maggie said. "She went down the village to see the vicar for something. How's your big brother then, Will?"
She always said this whenever she saw him. She meant Will's next-to-oldest brother, Max. It was a Stanton family joke that Maggie Barnes at Dawson's had a thing about Max.
"Fine, thank you," Will said politely. "Grown his hair long. Looks like a girl."
Maggie shrieked with delight.
"Get away with you."
She giggled and waved her farewell, and just at the last moment, Will noticed her gaze slip upward past his head. Out of the corner of his eye as he turned, he thought he saw a flicker of movement by the farmyard gate, as if someone were dodging quickly out of sight. But when he looked, no one was there. With the big pot of mincemeat wedged between two bales of hay, Will and James pushed the handcart out of the yard. The farmer stood in his doorway behind them. Will could feel his eyes, watching. He glanced up uneasily at the looming, growing clouds, and half unwillingly slipped a hand into his pocket to finger the strange iron circle.
"After the snow comes."
The sky looked as if it were about to fall on them. He thought,
"What's happening?"
One of the farm dogs came bounding up, tail waving. Then it stopped abruptly a few yards away, looking at them.
"Hey, racer," Will called.
The dog's tail went down, and it snarled, showing its teeth.
"James," said Will. "He won't hurt you. What's the matter?"
They went on and turned into the road.
"It's not that. Something's wrong, that's all. Something's awful. Racer, Chelsea, the animals are all scared of me."
He was beginning to be really frightened now. The noise from the rookery was louder, even though the daylight was beginning to die. They could see the dark birds thronging over the treetops, more agitated than before, flapping and turning to and fro. And Will had been right. There was a stranger in the lane, standing beside the churchyard. He was a shambling, tattered figure, more like a bundle of old clothes than a man, and at the sight of him, the boys slowed their pace and drew instinctively closer to the cart and to one another. He turned his shaggy head to look at them. Then suddenly, in a dreadful blur of unreality, a hoarse, shrieking flurry was rushing dark down out of the sky. And two huge rooks swooped at the man. He staggered back, shouting, his hands thrust up to protect his face, and the birds flapped their great wings in a black, vicious whirl and were gone, swooping up past the boys and into the sky. Will and James stood frozen, staring, pressed against the bales of hay. The stranger cowered back against the gate.
"Cark! Cark!"
came the head-splitting racket from the frenzied flock over the wood, and then three more whirling black shapes were swooping after the first two, diving wildly at the man and then away. This time he screamed in terror and stumbled out into the road, his arms still wrapped in defence round his head, his face down, and he ran. The boys heard the frightened gasps for breath as he dashed headlong past them, and up the road past the gates of Dawson's farm and on towards the village. They saw bushy, greasy grey hair below a dirty old cap, a torn brown overcoat tied with string, and some other garment flapping beneath it. Old boots, one with a loose sole that made him kick his leg oddly sideways, half-hopping as he ran. But they did not see his face. The high whirling above their heads was dwindling into loops of slow flight, and the rooks began to settle one by one into the trees. They were still talking loudly to one another in a long, cawing jumble, but the madness and the violence were not in it now. Dazed, moving his head for the first time, Will felt his cheek brush against something, and putting his hand to his shoulder, he found a long black feather there. He pushed it into his jacket pocket, moving slowly, like someone half awake. Together, they pushed the loaded cart down the road to the house, and the cawing behind them died to an ominous murmur like the swollen Thames in spring. James said at last, "Rooks don't do that sort of thing. They don't attack people. And they don't come down low when there's not much space. They just don't."
"No," Will said.
He was still moving in a detached half-dream, not fully aware of anything except a curious vague groping in his mind. In the midst of all the din and the flurry, he had suddenly had a strange feeling stronger than any he had ever known. He had been aware that someone was trying to tell him something, something that had missed him because he could not understand the words. Not words, exactly. It had been like a kind of silent shout. But he had not been able to pick up the message, because he had not known how. "Like not having the radio on the right station," he said aloud.
"What?"
said James, but he wasn't really listening.
"What a thing," he said. "I suppose the tramp must have been trying to catch a rook, and they got wild. He'll be snooping around after the hens and the rabbits, I bet you. Funny he didn't have a gun. Better tell Mum to leave the dogs in the barn tonight."
He chattered amiably on as they reached home and unloaded the hay. Gradually Will realized in amazement that all the shock of the wild, savage attack was running out of James's mind like water, and that in a matter of minutes, even the very fact of its happening had gone. Something had neatly wiped the whole incident from James's memory. Something that did not want it reported. Something that knew this would stop Will from reporting it too.
"Here, take Mum's mincemeat," James said. "Let's go in before we freeze. The wind's really getting up. Good job we hurried back."
"Yes," said Will. He felt cold, but it was not from the rising wind. His fingers closed round the iron circle in his pocket and held it tightly. This time, the iron felt warm. The grey world had slipped into the dark by the time they went back to the kitchen. Outside the window, their father's battered little van stood in a yellow cave of light. The kitchen was even noisier and hotter than before. Gwen was setting the table, patiently steering her way round a trio of bent figures, where Mr. Stanton was peering at some small, nameless piece of machinery with the twins, Robin and Paul. And with Mary's plump form now guarding it, the radio was blasting out pop music at enormous volume. As Will approached, it erupted again into a high-pitched screech, so that everyone broke off with grimaces and howls.
"Turn that thing off!"
Mrs. Stanton yelled desperately from the sink. But though Mary, pouting, shut off the crackle and the buried music, the noise level changed very little. Somehow it never did when more than half the family was at home. Voices and laughter filled the long stone-floored kitchen as they sat round the scrubbed wooden table. The two Welsh collies, Rack and Si, lay dozing at the far end of the room beside the fire. Will kept away from them. He could not have borne it if their own dogs had snarled at him. He sat quietly at tea. It was called tea if Mrs. Stanton managed to produce it before 5 o'clock, supper if it was later, but it was always the same hearty kind of meal, and kept his plate and his mouth full of sausage to avoid having to talk. Not that anyone was likely to miss your talk in the cheerful babble of the Stanton family, especially when you were its youngest member. Waving at him from the end of the table, his mother called, "What shall we have for tea tomorrow, Will?" He said indistinctly,
"Liver and bacon, please."
James gave a loud groan.
"Shut up," said Barbara, superior and 16. "It's his birthday, he can choose." "But liver," said James.
"Serves you right," Robin said. "On your last birthday, if I remember right, we all had to eat that revolting cauliflower cheese."
"I made it," said Gwen, "and it wasn't revolting."
"No offence," said Robin mildly. "I just can't bear cauliflower. Anyway, you take my point."
"I do. I don't know whether James does."
Robin, large and deep-voiced, was the more muscular of the twins, and not to be trifled with. James said hastily,
"Okay, okay."
"Double ones tomorrow, Will," said Mr. Stanton from the head of the table. "We should have some special kind of ceremony. A tribal rite."
He smiled at his youngest son, his round, rather chubby face crinkling in affection. Mary sniffed.
"On my 11th birthday, I was beaten and sent to bed." "Good heavens," said her mother. "Fancy you remembering that. And what a way to describe it. In point of fact, you got one hard wallop on the bottom, and well-deserved too, as far as I can recollect." "It was my birthday," Mary said, tossing her ponytail, "and I've never forgotten."
"Give yourself time," Robin said cheerfully. 3 years isn't much."
"And you were a very young 11,
Mrs. Stanton said, chewing reflectively.
"Hm," said Mary. "And I suppose Will isn't."
For a moment, everyone looked at Will. He blinked in alarm at the ring of contemplating faces, and scowled down at his plate, so that nothing of him was visible except a thick, slanting curtain of brown hair. It was most disturbing to be looked at by so many people all at once, or at any rate by more people than one could look at in return. He felt almost as if he were being attacked, and he was suddenly convinced that it could in some way be dangerous to have so many people thinking about him all at the same time, as if someone unfriendly might hear.
"Will," Gwen said at length, "is rather an old 11.
"Ageless, almost," Robin said.
They both sounded solemn and detached, as if they were discussing some far-off stranger.
"Let up now," said Paul unexpectedly.
He was the quiet twin, and the family genius, perhaps a real one. He played the flute and thought about little else.
"Anyone coming to tea tomorrow, Will?"
No. Angus MacDonald's gone to Scotland for Christmas, and Mike's staying with his granny in Southall. I don't mind."
There was a sudden commotion at the back door, and a blast of cold air, much stamping and noises of loud shivering. Max stuck his head into the room from the passage. His long hair was wet and white-starred.
"Sorry I'm late, Mum. I had to walk from the common."
"Wow, you should see it out there, like a blizzard."
He looked at the blank row of faces and grinned.
"Don't you know it's snowing?"
Forgetting everything for a moment, Will gave a joyful yell and scrambled with James for the door.
"Real snow? Heavy?"
"I'll say,"
said Max, scattering drops of water over them as he unwound his scarf. He was the eldest brother, not counting Stephen, who had been in the Navy for years and seldom came home.
"Here."
He opened the door a crack, and the wind whistled through again. Outside, Will saw a glittering white fog of fat snowflakes. No trees or bushes visible, nothing but the whirling snow. A chorus of protest came from the kitchen.
"Shut that door!"
"There's your ceremony, Will," said his father. "Right on time."
Much later, when he went to bed, Will opened the bedroom curtain and pressed his nose against the cold window pane, and he saw the snow tumbling down even thicker than before. 2 or 3 inches already lay on the sill, and he could almost watch the level rising as the wind drove more against the house. He could hear the wind, too, whining round the roof close above him and in all the chimneys. Will slept in a slant-roofed attic at the top of the house. He had moved into it only a few months before, when Stephen, whose room it had always been, had gone back to his ship after a leave. Until then, Will had always shared a room with James. Everyone in the family shared with someone else. "But my attic ought to be lived in," his eldest brother had said, knowing how Will loved it. On a bookcase in one corner of the room now stood a portrait of Lieutenant Stephen Stanton, R.N., looking rather uncomfortable in dress uniform, and beside it a carved wooden box with a dragon on the lid, filled with the letters he sent Will sometimes from unthinkably distant parts of the world. They made a kind of private shrine. The snow flurried against the window with a sound like fingers brushing the pane. Again Will heard the wind moaning in the roof, louder than before. It was rising into a real storm. He thought of the tramp, and wondered where he had taken shelter.
"The walker is abroad. This night will be bad."
He picked up his jacket and took the strange iron ornament from it, running his fingers round the circle, up and down the inner cross that quartered it. The surface of the iron was irregular, but though it showed no sign of having been polished, it was completely smooth. Smooth in a way that reminded him of a certain place in the rough stone floor of the kitchen, where all the roughness had been worn away by generations of feet turning to come round the corner from the door. It was an odd kind of iron. Deep, absolute black, with no shine to it, but no spot anywhere of discoloration or rust. And once more now, it was cold to the touch. So cold, this time, that Will was startled to find it numbing his fingertips. Hastily he put it down. Then he pulled his belt out of his trousers, slung untidily as usual over the back of a chair, took the circle, and threaded it through like an extra buckle, as Mr. Dawson had told him. The wind sang in the window frame. Will put the belt back in his trousers and dropped them on the chair. It was then, without warning, that the fear came. The first wave caught him as he was crossing the room to his bed. It halted him stock still in the middle of the room, the howl of the wind outside filling his ears. The snow lashed against the window. Will was suddenly deadly cold, yet tingling all over. He was so frightened that he could not move a finger. In a flash of memory he saw again the lowering sky over the spinney, dark with rooks, the big black birds wheeling and circling overhead. Then that was gone, and he saw only the tramp's terrified face and heard his scream as he ran. For a moment then there was only a dreadful darkness in his mind, a sense of looking into a great black pit. Then the high howl of the wind died, and he was released. He stood, shaking, looking wildly round the room. Nothing was wrong. Everything was just as usual. The trouble, he told himself, came from thinking. It would be all right if only he could stop thinking and go to sleep. He pulled off his dressing gown, climbed into bed, and lay there looking up at the skylight in the slanting roof. It was covered grey with snow. He switched off the small bedside lamp, and the night swallowed the room. There was no hint of light, even when his eyes had grown accustomed to the dark. Time to sleep. Go on. Go to sleep. But although he turned on his side, pulled the blankets up to his chin and lay there relaxed, contemplating the cheerful fact that it would be his birthday when he woke up, nothing happened. It was no good. Something was wrong. Will tossed uneasily. He had never known a feeling like this before. It was growing worse every minute. As if some huge weight were pushing at his mind, threatening, trying to take him over, turn him into something he didn't want to be. "That's it," he thought. "Make me into someone else.
But that's stupid. Who'd want to? And make me into what? Something creaked outside the half-open door, and he jumped. Then it creaked again, and he knew what it was. A certain floorboard that often talked to itself at night, with a sound so familiar that usually he never noticed it at all. In spite of himself, he still lay listening. A different kind of creak came from further away, in the other attic, and he twitched again, jerking so that the blanket rubbed against his chin. "You're just jumpy," he said to himself. "You're remembering this afternoon, but really there isn't much to remember." He tried to think of the tramp as someone unremarkable, just an ordinary man with a dirty overcoat and worn-out boots. But instead, all he could see once more was the vicious diving of the rooks.
"The walker is abroad."
Another strange, crackling noise came, this time above his head in the ceiling, and the wind whined suddenly loud, and Will sat bolt upright in bed and reached in panic for the lamp. The room was at once a cozy cave of yellow light, and he lay back in shame, feeling stupid. Frightened of the dark, he thought. How awful! Just like a baby. Stephen would never have been frightened of the dark up here. Look, there's the bookcase and the table, the two chairs and the window seat. Look, there are the six little square riggers of the mobile hanging from the ceiling, and their shadows sailing over there on the wall. Everything's ordinary. Go to sleep. He switched off the light again, and instantly everything was even worse than before. The fear jumped at him for the third time like a great animal that had been waiting to spring. Will lay terrified, shaking, feeling himself shake, and yet unable to move. He felt he must be going mad. Outside, the wind moaned, paused, rose into a sudden howl, and there was a noise, a muffled scraping thump against the skylight in the ceiling of his room. And then, in a dreadful, furious moment, horror seized him like a nightmare made real. There came a wrenching crash, with the howling of the wind suddenly much louder and closer, and a great blast of cold. And the feeling came hurtling against him with such force of dread that it flung him cowering away. Will shrieked. He only knew it afterwards. He was far too deep in fear to hear the sound of his own voice. For an appalling pitch-black moment he lay scarcely conscious, lost somewhere out of the world, out in black space. And then there were quick footsteps up the stairs outside his door, and a voice, calling in concern, and blessed light warming the room and bringing him back into life again. It was Paul's voice. "Will? What is it? Are you all right?" Slowly, Will opened his eyes. He found that he was clenched into the shape of a ball, with his knees drawn up tight against his chin. He saw Paul standing over him, blinking anxiously behind his dark-rimmed spectacles. He nodded, without finding his voice. Then Paul turned his head, and Will followed his looking and saw that the skylight in the roof was hanging open, still swaying with the force of its fall. There was a black square of empty night in the roof, and through it the wind was bringing in a bitter midwinter cold. On the carpet below the skylight lay a heap of snow. Paul peered at the edge of the skylight frame. "Catch is broken. I suppose the snow was too heavy for it. Must have been pretty old anyway, the metal's all rusted. I'll get some wire and fix it up till tomorrow. Did it wake you? Lord, what a horrible shock. If I woke up like that, you'd find me somewhere under the bed." Will looked at him in speechless gratitude and managed a watery smile. Every word in Paul's soothing, deep voice brought him closer back to reality. He sat up in bed and pulled back the covers. "Dad must have some wire with that junk in the other attic," Paul said. "But let's get this snow out before it melts. Look, there's more coming in. I bet there aren't many houses where you can watch the snow coming down on the carpet." He was right. Snowflakes were whirling in through the black space in the ceiling, scattering everywhere. Together they gathered what they could into a misshapen snowball on an old magazine, and Will scuttled downstairs to drop it in the bath. Paul wired the skylight back to its catch. "There now," he said briskly. And though he did not look at Will, for an instant they understood one another very well. "Tell you what, Will, it's freezing up here. Why don't you go down to our room and sleep in my bed?
and I'll wake you when I come up later. Or I might even sleep up here if you can survive Robin snoring. All right?
All right, Will said huskily. Thanks.
He picked up his discarded clothes, with the belt and its new ornament, and bundled them under his arm, then paused at the door as they went out, and looked back. There was nothing to see now except a dark, damp patch on the carpet where the heap of snow had been. But he felt colder than the cold air had made him, and the sick, empty feeling of fear still lay in his chest. If there had been nothing wrong beyond being frightened of the dark, he would not for the world have gone down to take refuge in Paul's room. But as things were, he knew he could not stay alone in the room where he belonged. For when they were clearing up that heap of fallen snow, he had seen something that Paul had not. It was impossible in a howling snowstorm for anything living to have made that soft, unmistakable thud against the glass that he had heard just before the skylight fell. But buried in the heap of snow, he had found the fresh black wing feather of a rook. He heard the farmer's voice again.
"This night will be bad, and tomorrow will be beyond imagining."
Midwinter Day. He was woken by music. It beckoned him, lilting and insistent. Delicate music played by delicate instruments that he could not identify, with one rippling bell-like phrase running through it in a gold thread of delight. There was in this music so much of the deepest enchantment of all his dreams and imaginings that he woke smiling in pure happiness at the sound. In the moment of his waking it began to fade, beckoning as it went, and then as he opened his eyes, it was gone. He had only the memory of that one rippling phrase still echoing in his head, and itself fading so fast that he sat up abruptly in bed and reached his arm out to the air, as if he could bring it back. The room was very still, and there was no music, and yet Will knew that it had not been a dream. He was in the twins' room still. He could hear Robin's breathing slow and deep from the other bed. Cold light glimmered round the edge of the curtains, but no one was stirring anywhere. It was very early. Will pulled on his rumpled clothes from the day before and slipped out of the room. He crossed the landing to the central window and looked down. In the first shining moment he saw the whole strange, familiar world glistening white, the roof of the outbuildings mounted into square towers of snow, and beyond them all the fields and hedges buried, merged into one great flat expanse, unbroken white to the horizon's brim. Will drew in a long, happy breath, silently rejoicing. Then very faintly he heard the music again, the same phrase. He swung round vainly, searching for it in the air, as if he might see it somewhere like a flickering light.
"Where are you?"
It had gone again. And when he looked back through the window, he saw that his own world had gone with it. In that flash, everything had changed. The snow was there as it had been a moment before, but not piled now on roofs or stretching flat over lawns and fields. There were no roofs. There were no fields. There were only trees. Will was looking over a great white forest. A forest of massive trees, sturdy as towers and ancient as rock. They were bare of leaves, clad only in the deep snow that lay untouched along every branch, each smallest twig. They were everywhere. They began so close to the house that he was looking out through the topmost branches of the nearest tree, and could have reached out and shaken them if he had dared to open the window. All around him the trees stretched to the flat horizon of the valley. The only break in that white world of branches was away over to the south where the Thames ran. He could see the bend in the river marked like a single stilled wave in this white ocean of forest, and the shape of it looked as though the river were wider than it should have been. Will gazed and gazed, and when at last he stirred, he found that he was clutching the smooth iron circle threaded onto his belt. The iron was warm to his touch. He went back into the bedroom.
"Robin," he said loudly, "wake up."
But Robin breathed slowly and rhythmically as before, and did not stir. He ran into the bedroom next door, the familiar small room that he had once shared with James, and shook James roughly by the shoulder. But when the shaking was done, James lay motionless, deeply asleep. Will went out onto the landing again and took a long breath, and he shouted with all his might, "Wake up! Wake up, everyone!" He did not now expect any response, and none came. There was a total silence, as deep and timeless as the blanketing snow. The house and everyone in it lay in a sleep that would not be broken. Will went downstairs to pull on his boots and the old sheepskin jacket that had belonged before him to two or three of his brothers in turn. Then he went out of the back door, closing it quietly behind him, and stood looking out through the quick white vapour of his breath. The strange white world lay stroked by silence. No birds sang. The garden was no longer there in this forested land, nor were the outbuildings, nor the old crumbling walls. There lay only a narrow clearing round the house now, hummocked with unbroken snowdrifts, before the trees began, with a narrow path leading away. Will set out down the white tunnel of the path, slowly, stepping high to keep the snow out of his boots. As soon as he moved away from the house, he felt very much alone, and he made himself go on without looking back over his shoulder, because he knew that when he looked, he would find that the house was gone. He accepted everything that came into his mind without thought or question, as if he were moving through a dream. But a deeper part of him knew that he was not dreaming. He was crystal clear awake, in a midwinter day that had been waiting for him to wake into it since the day he had been born, and, he somehow knew, for centuries before that.
"Tomorrow will be beyond imagining."
Will came out of the white arched path into the road, paved smooth with snow and edged everywhere by the great trees, and he looked up between the branches and saw a single black rook flap slowly past, high in the early sky. Turning to the right, he walked up the narrow road that in his own time was called Huntercombe Lane. It was the way that he and James had taken to Dawson's farm, the same road that he had trodden almost every day of his life, but it was very different now. Now, it was no more than a track through a forest, great snow-burdened trees enclosing it on both sides. Will moved bright-eyed and watchful through the silence, until, suddenly, he heard a faint noise ahead of him. He stood still. The sound came again through the muffling trees, a rhythmical, off-key tapping like a hammer striking metal. It came in short, irregular bursts, as though someone were hammering nails. As he stood listening, the world around him seemed to brighten a little. The woods seemed less dense, the snow glittered, and when he looked upward, the strip of sky over Huntercombe Lane was a clear blue. He realized that the sun had risen at last out of the sullen bank of grey cloud. He trudged on towards the sound of hammering and soon came to a clearing. There was no village of Huntercombe anymore, only this. All his senses sprang to life at once, under a shower of unexpected sounds, sights, smells. He saw two or three low stone buildings, thick-roofed with snow. He saw blue wood smoke rising, and smelt it too, and smelt at the same time a voluptuous scent of new-baked bread that brought the water springing in his mouth. He saw that the nearest of the three buildings was three-walled, open to the track, with a yellow fire burning bright inside it, like a captive sun. Great showers of sparks were spraying out from an anvil where a man was hammering. Beside the anvil stood a tall black horse, a beautiful, gleaming animal. Will had never seen a horse so splendidly midnight in colour, with no white markings anywhere. The horse raised its head and looked full at him, pawed the ground and gave a low whinny. The smith's voice rumbled in protest, and another figure moved out of the shadows behind the horse. Will's breath came faster at the sight of him, and he felt a hollowness in his throat. He did not know why. The man was tall and wore a dark cloak that fell straight like a robe. His hair, which grew low over his neck, shone with a curious reddish tinge. He patted the horse's neck, murmuring in its ear. Then he seemed to sense the cause of its restlessness, and he turned and saw Will. His arms dropped abruptly. He took a step forward and stood there waiting. The brightness went out of the snow and the sky, and the morning darkened a little, as an extra layer of the distant cloud bank swallowed the sun. Will crossed the road through the snow, his hands thrust deep into his pockets. He did not look at the tall, cloaked figure facing him. Instead, he stared resolutely at the other man, bent again now over the anvil, and realized that he knew him. It was one of the men from Dawson's farm. John Smith, old George's son.
"Morning, John," he said.
The broad-shouldered man in the leather apron glanced up. He frowned briefly, then nodded in welcome.
"Hey, well, you're out early."
"It's my birthday," Will said.
"A midwinter birthday," said the strange man in the cloak. "Auspicious indeed. And you will be 11 years grown."
It was a statement, not a question. Now Will had to look. Bright blue eyes went with the red-brown hair, and the man spoke with a curious accent that was not of the southeast.
"That's right," Will said.
A woman came out of one of the nearby cottages carrying a basket of small loaves of bread, and with them the new-baked smell that had so tantalized Will before. He sniffed, his stomach reminding him that he had eaten no breakfast. The red-haired man took a loaf, wrenched it apart, and held out a half towards him.
"Here. You're hungry. Break your birthday fast with me, young Will."
He bit into the remaining half of the loaf, and Will heard the crust crackle invitingly. He reached forward, but as he did so, the smith swung a hot horseshoe out of his fire and clapped it briefly on the hoof clenched between his knees. There was a quick, smoky smell of burning, killing the scent of the new bread. Then the shoe was back in the fire and the smith peering at the hoof. The black horse stood patient and unmoving, but Will stepped back, dropping his arm.
"No, thank you," he said.
The man shrugged, tearing wolfishly at his bread, and the woman, her face invisible behind the edge of an enveloping shawl, went away again with her basket. John Smith swung the horseshoe out of the fire to sizzle and steam in a bucket of water.
"Get on! Get on!" said the rider irritably, raising his head. "The day grows. How much longer?" "Your iron will not be hurried," said the smith.
But he was hammering the shoe in place now with quick, sure strokes.
"Done,"
he said at last, trimming the hoof with a knife. The red-haired man led his horse round, tightened the girths, and slid upwards, quick as a jumping cat, into his saddle. Towering there with the folds of his dark robe flowing over the flanks of the black horse, he looked like a statue carved out of night. But the blue eyes were staring compellingly down at Will.
"Come up, boy. I'll take you where you want to go. Riding is the only way in snow as thick as this."
"No, thank you," Will said. "I am out to find the walker."
He heard his own words with amazement.
"So that's it," he thought. "But now the rider is abroad,"
the man said, and all in one quick movement he twitched his horse's head around, bent in the saddle, and made a sweeping grab at Will's arm. Will jerked sideways, but he would have been seized if the smith, standing at the open wall of the forge, had not leapt forward and dragged him out of reach. For so broad a man, he moved with astonishing speed. The midnight stallion reared, and the cloaked rider was almost thrown. He shouted in fury, then recovered himself, and sat looking down in a cold contemplation that was more terrible than rage.
"That was a foolish move, my friend Smith," he said softly. "We shall not forget."
Then he swung the stallion round and rode out in the direction from which Will had come, and the hooves of his great horse made only a muffled whisper in the snow. John Smith spat derisively and began hanging up his tools.
"Thank you," Will said. "I hope..."
He stopped.
"They can do me no harm," the smith said. "I come of the wrong breed for that. And in this time I belong to the road, as my craft belongs to all those who use the road. Their power can work no harm on the road through Hunter's Coombe. Remember that for yourself."
The dream state flickered, and Will felt his thoughts begin to stir.
"John," he said, "I know it's true I must find the Walker, but I don't know why. Will you tell me?"
The smith turned and looked directly at him for the first time with a kind of compassion in his weathered face.
"Ah, no, young Will. You so newly awake. That you must learn for yourself. And much more this your first day."
"First day," said Will.
"Eat," said the smith. "There is no danger in it now that you will not be breaking bread with the rider. You see how quickly you saw the peril of that? Just as you knew there would be greater peril in riding with him. Follow your nose through the day, boy, just follow your nose."
He called to the house.
"Martha!"
The woman came out again with her basket. This time she drew back her shawl and smiled at Will, and he saw blue eyes like the rider's, but with a softer light in them. Gratefully he munched at the warm, crusty bread, which had been split now and spread with honey. Then beyond the clearing there was a new sound of muffled footfalls in the road, and he spun fearfully round. A white mare, without rider or harness, trotted into the clearing towards them. A reverse image of the rider's midnight black stallion, tall and splendid and without marking of any kind. Against the dazzle of the snow, glittering now as the sun re-emerged from cloud, there seemed a faint golden glow in its whiteness and in the long mane falling over the arched neck. The horse came to stand beside Will, bent its nose briefly and touched his shoulder as if in greeting, then tossed its great white head, blowing a cloud of misty breath into the cold air. Will reached out and laid a reverent hand on its neck.
"You come in good time," John Smith said. "A fire is hot."
He went back into the forge and pumped once or twice at the bellows arm so that the fire roared. Then he hooked down a shoe from the shadowed wall beyond and thrust it into the heat.
"Look well," he said, studying Will's face. "You've not seen a horse like this ever before, but this will not be the last time."
"She's beautiful," Will said,
and the mare nuzzled again gently at his neck.
"Mount," said the smith.
Will laughed. It was so obviously impossible. His head reached scarcely to the horse's shoulder, and even if there had been a stirrup, it would have been far out of reach of his foot.
"I'm not joking," said the smith.
And indeed he did not look like the kind of man who often smiled, let alone made a joke.
"It is your privilege. Take hold of her mane where you can reach it, and you will see."
To humour him, Will reached up and wound the fingers of both hands in the long coarse hair of the white horse's mane, low on the neck. In the same instant, he felt giddy. His head hummed like a spinning top, and behind the sound he heard, quite plainly but very far off, the haunting, bell-like phrase of music that he had heard before waking that morning. He cried out. His arms jerked strangely. The world spun, and the music was gone. His mind was still groping desperately to recover it, when he realized that he was closer to the snow-thick branches of the trees than he had been before, sitting high on the white mare's broad back. He looked down at the smith and laughed aloud in delight.
"When she is shod," the smith said, "she will carry you, if you ask."
Will sobered suddenly, thinking. Then something drew his gaze up through the arching trees to the sky, and he saw two black rooks flapping lazily past, high up.
"No," he said. "I think I'm supposed to go alone."
He stroked the mare's neck, swung his legs to one side, and slid the long way down, bracing himself for a jolt. But he found that he landed lightly on his toes in the snow.
"Thank you, John. Thank you very much. Goodbye."
The smith nodded briefly, then busied himself with the horse, and Will trudged off in some disappointment. He had expected a word of farewell, at least. From the edge of the trees he glanced back. John Smith had one of the mare's hind feet clenched between his knees, and was reaching his gloved hand for his tongs. And what Will saw then made him forget any thought of words or farewells. The smith had done no removing of old horseshoes or trimming of a shoe-torn foot. This horse had never been shod before, and the shoe that was now being fitted to its foot, like the line of three other shoes that he could now see glinting on the far smithy wall, was not a horseshoe at all, but another shape, a shape he knew very well. All four of the white mare's shoes were replicas of the cross-quartered circle that he wore on his own belt. Will walked a little way down the road, beneath its narrow roof of blue sky. He put a hand inside his jacket to touch the circle on his belt, and the iron was icy cold. He was beginning to know what that meant by now. But there was no sign of the rider. He could not even see any tracks left by the black horse's feet, and he was not thinking of evil encounters. He could feel only that something was drawing him more and more strongly towards the place where in his own time Dawson's farm would stand. He found the narrow side lane and turned down it. The track went on a long way, winding in gentle turns. There seemed to be a lot of scrub in this part of the forest. The branching tops of small trees and bushes jutted snow-laden from the mounding drifts, like white antlers from white rounded heads. And then, round the next bend, Will saw before him a low square hut with rough daubed clay walls and a roof high with a hat of snow like a thick iced cake. In the doorway, paused irresolute with one hand on the rickety door, stood the shambling old tramp of the day before. The long grey hair was the same, and so were the clothes and the wizened, crafty face. Will came close to the old man and said, as Farmer Dawson had said the day before,
"So the walker is abroad?"
"Only the one," said the old man. "Only me. And what's it to you?"
He sniffed, squinting sideways at Will, and rubbed his nose on one greasy sleeve.
"I want you to tell me some things," Will said, more boldly than he felt. "I want to know why you were hanging around yesterday. Why you were watching. Why the rooks came after you." "I want to know," he said in a sudden honest rush, "what it means that you were the walker."
At the mention of the rooks, the old man had flinched closer to the hut, his eyes flickering nervously up at the treetops. But now he looked at Will in sharper suspicion than before.
"You can't be the one," he said.
"I can't be what?"
"You can't be. You ought to know all this, especially about those hellish birds. Trying to trick me, eh? Trying to trick a poor old man. You are out with the rider, ain't you? You are his boy, ain't you, eh?"
"Of course not," Will said. "I don't know what you mean."
He looked at the wretched hut. The lane ended here, but there was scarcely even a proper clearing. The trees stood close all round them, shutting out much of the sun. He said, suddenly desolate,
"Where's the farm?"
"There isn't any farm," said the old tramp impatiently. "Not yet. You ought to know."
He sniffed again violently and mumbled to himself. Then his eyes narrowed and he came close to Will, peering into his face and giving off a strong repellent smell of ancient sweat and unwashed skin.
"But you might be the one. You might. If you're carrying the first sign that the old one gave you. Have you got it there, then? Show it. Show the old walker the sign."
Trying hard not to back away in disgust, Will fumbled with the buttons of his jacket. He knew what the sign must be. But as he pushed the sheepskin aside to show the circle looped on his belt, his hand brushed against the smooth iron and felt it burning, biting with icy cold. At the same moment he saw the old man leap backwards, cringing, staring not at him but behind him, over his shoulder. Will swung round. and saw the cloaked rider on his midnight horse.
"Well met," said the rider softly.
The old man squealed like a frightened rabbit, and turned and ran, blundering through the snowdrifts into the tree.